Hello and welcome to another episode of Talk About Tomorrow, the Futurists podcast with me, Tom Cheesewright. This week, as usual, two stories. First of all, what happens when half our money is spent online? And then, disrupting house building. How do we solve the housing crisis? When half our money is spent online. In May 2020, online retail sales in the UK peaked at 32.8% of all transactions. The number later dropped off to 26.6% as some shoppers returned to stores. But the direction of travel is clear. The percentage of retail sales happening online has tripled in a decade. A year earlier, The Guardian covered a report by Retail Economics that suggested that 53% of sales could be online by 2029. With the trend accelerating effect of the COVID-19 pandemic and lockdown, this seems more likely than ever. So what happens when half of all sales are online? According to the Centre for Retail Research, 125,000 retail jobs were lost in the first 8 months of 2020. At the time, it seemed unlikely to me that this number would stay under 200,000 for the full year, and the CRR concurred. The final figure ended up around 183,000. Lots of retailers were already weak going into the crisis. 47% were at significant risk of failure, according to the 2020 Grimsey Review. With GDP dropping 20%, it was clear we were in a financial crisis of 2008 levels or beyond. Any serious weakness was likely to be terminal, and major names like Oasis, TM Lewin, and Victoria's Secret fell into administration. Of course, the growth in online retail creates jobs as well, but the type of jobs it creates are rather different and very polarised. At one end, there are warehouse and logistics jobs for deliveries. These tend to be jobs with little security, either short-term or long-term. Warehouse automation, drones and self-driving delivery vehicles will likely eliminate most of these jobs in the next 30 to 40 years. At the other end, there are the office-based design, technology, buying and marketing jobs that tend to be highly skilled and well-paid. These jobs are much more secure, but there are many fewer of them. One central team can serve a whole nation, if not the whole world, rather than requiring representatives in each store. Today, roughly 3 million people are employed in the retail industry in the UK. Back in 2016, the British Retail Consortium predicted that would be down to 2 million by 2025. At the time of writing, there were roughly 3 million people employed in the retail industry in the UK. Back in 2016, the British Retail Consortium predicted that would be down to 2 million by 2025. That certainly seems likely, with perhaps another 500,000 going in the following 5 years as the transition to online continues. Meanwhile, on the high street, vacancy rates are at their highest for 6 years, with 11% of stores vacant in July 2020. In April, not long before it collapsed into insolvency, shopping centre operator Intu said that it received just 29% of rent due in the previous quarter. The new operators of Intu's locations are full of optimism about the prospect of bringing in smaller local retailers. But rents will undoubtedly have to fall to attract them in. The same is true on the high street, where small retailers who have historically felt priced out by the combination of rent and rates are now seeing opportunities. But long-term rates reform is clearly needed, with many calling for changes to the way rates are calculated and reviewed, and some suggesting more radical changes such as a local sales tax. No level of rent or rates cuts is going to conjure up new product categories, though, or change buyer behaviour. The simple reality is that many of the product categories that used to fill the high streets no longer exist. Media is now mostly digital. Rent and rate cuts might bring independent book and record stores into the main strip, but that only leaves vacancies elsewhere. The convergence of electronics into the phone has undermined gadget retailers. Gaming's future looks to be streamed or at least downloaded. Fashion remains the category with the greatest apparent potential, with the social factor of clothes shopping and the practical reality of trying things on. But online is still taking a big bite, around a fifth of fashion sales pre-lockdown. And at some point, consumer trends are likely to turn against fast fashion, whether over its water consumption, climate impact, labour ethics, or just raw consumerism. Big brands may find themselves sharing space and wallets with charity and vintage stores. Most of all, though, they will find themselves sharing high streets and shopping centres with other classes of tenant. Schools, housing, health centres, and much, much more. Apart from pure geography, what makes a city centre? What differentiates it from other districts or suburbs? In megacities, those with more than 10 million inhabitants, and those approaching this scale, like London, there are already multiple centres with different characters and specialisms. As retail becomes less of a feature of the city core, will the differentiation between centre and suburb start to decline? It seems likely to me that as more space in centres currently devoted to offices and retail gets turned over to housing and amenities, the unique character of the city centre is diminished. While its assets in terms of transport access and location will continue to differentiate it from the suburbs, we might see cities become more of an ensemble cast rather than having a single star. This could start to change the flows of people around the city, reducing peak volumes and changing routes. It might have an impact on property prices and planning. Lots of people are clearly aware that the crisis in retail is ongoing. But it also feels like much of the conversation about restoring town and city centres was based on an idea that the damage has already been done. That the one-third vacancy rates in some places after the 2008 crash was as bad as it would get. In fact, it looks like it might get much worse. There are years of disruption still to come for the offline retail sector, and the effects will require continued intervention from government, both local and national. They will need to deal with the structural job losses, the property vacancies, and the resulting losses in business rates. It will take time to bring new visions for town and city centres to fruition. There is a glimmer of light here. The vision presented by the potential to reshape cities away from a single core presents some potential benefits. But for retail, there is a long, dark tunnel ahead. Disrupting house building. Every year, everyone seems to agree that we need to build more homes. But while the number was growing up until the end of 2019, we shall see what impact COVID has had, we're still away from the government's target of 300,000 homes a year. And even at current levels, around 240,000 built or converted last year, house prices continue to soar. The average house price is now over 10 times the average household income. So how do we build more homes? More importantly, how do we build more homes in the places people want them? Homes that fulfil people's changing needs, and whose construction and use has a minimal or even positive impact on the environment. I think the answer might come from some of the most successful businesses of the last few years. Businesses that build scale through networks of small operations, like Uber and Airbnb. These businesses have their ethical issues and their operational issues too. But the principle of scaling small things is a powerful one. This is an essay. It's not something anyone has paid me to research, and hence I'm not going to get everything right here. But hear me out. I'd love to hear your feedback. This is my recipe for a disruptive house builder. My disruptive house builder would operate on three simple principles. Number one, make it easier to build than buy. Number two, make it cheaper to build than rent. And number three, give people security and sustainability. How would you do this? Imagine aggregating all of the small plots of land around the UK into a single liquid marketplace. Imagine wrapping around them a layer of digital services for surveying and planning, creating a low-friction pipeline for acquiring and developing sites. Land Insight has already done most of the work here with its award-winning platform. I was one of the judges a few years ago when it won the Placetech Prize for Innovation. Take its API and build from there. Now people can search for parcels of land near them and begin to progress them. A truly liquid market for land, with some of the complexity of planning and utilisation removed, will attract more people wanting to sell their land, increasing the size of the market. This somewhat glosses over the complexities of the planning space, but many small-scale projects should be much easier to progress than large-scale projects that attract a lot of attention, especially if you standardise some of the homes. I'm not talking about ticky-tacky boxes on a hillside here. I think the starting point for this house builder should be WikiHouse, an open, modular system of house design with a relatively low carbon footprint and a huge degree of flexibility. Imagine being able to design your house in an app like the IKEA Kitchen Configurator. Once you have picked your plot, the system pulls in 3D scans of the area and allows you to overlay the footprint and a 3D render of your house with a range of design options and interior fittings from its catalogue. Or you can choose a bare shell with utilities and fit it out yourself. The great thing about WikiHouse is that it is largely manufactured off-site in small, local workshops. You don't need to own these as the developer. Just have access to a network of them and monitor standards. Over time, this will get easier as individual house builders start to contribute reviews. Once the design is approved, the customer can select a local manufacturer to produce their panels and frame. You will also need local contractors to assemble the home, but the nature of WikiHouse means it requires a lot less skilled labour, an issue already and one that will grow as we go through Brexit. You could either plug into an existing network of contractors, like Rated People, or build one up. And as the business grows, you are likely to develop a class of freelance contractor that specialises in assembly. This all sounds well and good, but it's not that radical. Mostly just plugging together existing networks with some nice front-end design. What makes this house builder really disruptive is the funding. Imagine if you could take great gobs of investment from pension funds, venture capital, or even government and use it to do home financing differently. After all, based on the business described above, you wouldn't need to spend that much actually building anything. You're leveraging existing assets, and there is a lot of cash around at the moment, seeking reliable returns. Where better to invest than in property? Even with the population set to start declining in the second half of the century, it doesn't look like demand for quality homes will shrink anytime soon. Use that funding to make deposits small, not much bigger than you might put down on a rental, but base it on smarter credit checks that overcome some of the weaknesses inherent in current systems, like the ones that would deny me a mortgage because I'm self-employed, even though I haven't missed a payment in 15 years. Though there are arguably issues with privacy, banks in China have been making heavy use of alternative data sources. Not just have you paid your credit card bill in the past, but who you are based on social media and more. This has allowed them to process loans automatically and incredibly quickly with very low rates of non-payment. Offer people a truly flexible mortgage. Shared ownership options from 10% up to 100%. Make it variable over time. When times are good, increase your payments to buy more of the equity. When they're bad, trade equity for a payment holiday or switch seamlessly to interest only. The aim is to keep people covering the cost of the financing, but also to keep them in their home as long as is viable. Make it easy for groups to buy together and trade equity between them. With our extended adolescence, it should be much less work for groups of friends to club together to build than it is right now. And the scale of their expenditure on rents should make mortgages eminently viable, were it not for the barrier of the big deposit. Combining a tailored approach to construction, low-friction operations, distributed manufacturing and the utilisation of small plots, it should be possible to open up home ownership to a much larger group of people. People with the cash flow to fund it, but who are priced out by the lack of supply and the scale of the upfront investment. This should be an ideal investment opportunity for those seeking long-term returns. And there is an enormous market to address with people hungry for alternatives. Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed those stories. Reading them back myself, two stories that I wrote back in 2020, I now question some of the premises, certainly in the house building one. I wonder whether we should be building that many more houses, given the incredible pressures placed on us by the rising effects of climate change and the need to address our carbon footprint. But that's the challenge, isn't it? The challenge of the future is always about balancing interests. I'd love to hear your thoughts. If you like the way I think, please do go and grab a book. Find High Frequency Change and future-proof your business, well, anywhere you buy your books, really. And if you could leave a review, that'd be very welcome. Thanks again for listening. Bye-bye.